When did you first come to the university?
I first came here in 1965. Yes.
As an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate, yes. And I did an undergraduate project here, which was credited to my bachelor's degree, which I was obtaining from Nigeria.
Okay.
Yes.
So how did you decide to come to Michigan State?
Well, it is a combination of circumstances. First of all, the university that I attended in Nigeria was established by Michigan State University, called the University of Nigeria.
Okay.
When I was graduating, the year, my junior year, I had the opportunity of studying abroad, and that was here at Michigan State University. Okay. And so when I finished my bachelor's degree, I had been given several assistantships here.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, I had been awarded the United States Agency for International Development Scholarship.
You know, okay.
So that's what brought me back here.
And so you came back as a graduate student?
Yes, I came back as a graduate student, right.
And this was before we had a medical school?
That was before we had a medical school,
okay.
Right.
What do you remember hearing about medical school when you were a graduate student?
You know, by the time I came here, really, there was already in place rudiments of what became the medical school, and that was personnel.
Okay.
Personnel had arrived in 1964, I presumed. In 64, because we celebrated our 40th year last year.
Mm-hmm.
So in 64, the personnel were here already, designated as the core and the founders of the medical school. The first students were not admitted into the medical school until I had been here.
Right.
Okay. And so the information that was disseminated was that there was going to be a unique community-oriented medical school that serves the mission of the university as a land-grant institution. One of the things that was said quite often was that the land-grant philosophy upon which this institution evolved required that the needs of the society should be addressed.
Right.
And healthcare needs was an important part of the society's needs. And it was therefore strange that a university that has its mission the service of the people will not have a medical school. And so that was the kind of argument that were being sold out there at that time. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have contact at that time with people who were the medical school?
Not directly. Mm-hmm. Not directly. Personally, not directly. My first contacts with people in the medical school did not occur until 1968, when I was now a junior faculty. I had finished my master's degree at that time, and I was now a junior faculty. So it was in 1968 that my first real contacts with individuals in the medical school began to blossom, right?
Okay, and who was that?
Bill Weil. Art Coleman, Thomas Helmrath, Teresa Hardy, all of those individuals were the core of what became the Department of Human Development. And they were those that I had contacts with because of my training in human genetics. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of contacts with them.
Okay. And were you still a graduate student at that time, or had you finished?
No, in 1968, I was still a graduate student. Okay. Yes, I was still a graduate student. I was at towards the end of my doctorate degree.
Mm-hmm. And am I remembering correctly that you worked with Jim Higgins in his laboratory?
That's correct. I did work with Jim Higgins in his laboratory, right.
What was that like?
Oh, it was a very rich experience. At that time, I had become a senior graduate student, so I was actually helping him to supervise the younger graduate students. We, at that time, through the help of the Department of Human Development, were able to get the Michigan Department of Public Health to give us a contract to look at all of the institutions for the mentally retarded at that time, which were scattered all over the state, to look for genetic conditions which would have predisposed those individuals to being institutionalized. And Jim Higgins and I did all of those surveys, right?
Yeah. What did you find?
Well, we found quite a lot of interesting phenomena. We found a lot of chromosomal abnormalities. We found a lot of syndromes which had been described, some not yet described, and we described them. We found a lot of metabolic errors, some described, some not yet described. We described them. In fact, my PhD thesis was a description of one of those metabolic errors. Yes.
Okay. And we were also doing some community surveys. I remember, and I'm vague on this, but I don't know whether you were doing it or Higgins was talking about it, a community near Lapeer where there was a lot of sort of inbreeding.
Well, yes. The Lapeer community that we really looked at was the institution for the mentally retarded, Lapeer State Home and Training School, they called it. Lapeer State Home and Training School. While we were doing that, we found that there were a lot of individuals in those homes that were products of consanguinity, which is the inbreeding you talked about.
Yeah.
Yes. A lot of them were products of consanguinity.
Yeah. And did you also do a lead level survey in Lansing?
No, I did not. But the department did, and I was not really involved in that. Okay. But we did in our group, in the genetics group, we did the survey of the sickle cell gene in the Lansing community.
Okay, that may be what I'm thinking
of. Yes, we did the survey of the sickle cell gene in the Lansing community, which actually received a lot of press coverage.
Yes. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because at that time, as you recall, in 1968-69, that was the peak of the civil rights movement.
Yes.
And the black populations felt that they were trivialized and their health problems were trivialized. There was a lot of talk, particularly by activists who have very little information, you know, and they go and blow it out of proportions. So at that time, we had two graduate students, junior graduate students, who needed projects. And so I then talked to Jim. I said, look, there's a project we could do. You know, a total public screening of the black population for the sickle cell gene so that we can better define the sickle cell gene. because people are throwing out figures out there which I don't believe. Let's look at the sickle cell gene and see what proportion of the black population really carry the gene and what proportion of them really have the disease. So, and she said, look, that sounds like a good idea. So I then started writing grant proposals. I wrote a proposal to the Urban League, got some money from the Urban League. I wrote some grant proposal to the Center for Urban Affairs here. Right. I got some grant from them. I wrote a proposal to the Model Cities Program in Lancet. I got some grant money from them. So with all of that money, we were able to put together a survey, a good survey, yeah. which was well received nationally, actually.
I can't imagine being able to go door to door and draw blood today.
No, that will not happen today. Yeah. No IRB will allow you to do that today. None. Yeah.
During this period, did you have much contact with other members of the department?
Oh, yeah, a lot. Because we ran the genetics clinic once every week.
Okay.
And all members of the department were involved in that genetics clinic.
Tell me about that.
Well, yes.
Beno Saroj was involved.
Yes, Saroj was involved. Dr. Kapoor was involved. Art Corman was involved. Okay. Even Bill Ware was involved, you know. we usually held pre-clinic conferences before the clinic and then the post-clinic conferences where almost every member of the department came, where we reviewed all the cases we saw, the abnormalities, and we assigned responsibilities as to delineating those abnormalities better. And it was a very rich experience for me because at that time, my knowledge was purely genetics. Yep. I didn't have any clinical knowledge, as you recall. And so
this was before you went to medical
school? Before I went to medical school, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yes. And so that was a very good experience, actually.
Was there something about the nature of the department that you think enriched the experience? Could you have that same kind of experience, say, at U of M or UCSD? Or?
No, that will not have happened because the uniqueness of that experience came from the fact that everybody and every specialty had an input. It was what you call a comprehensive healthcare. You had an input as a sociologist. We had a social worker at that time. I can't remember the name now. Had an input. We had a lawyer at that time, had an input, advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
So we had different individuals bringing together both the social sciences and the biological sciences and the clinical sciences, bringing them all together into the care of an individual. It was a very special experience at that time. Yes. And everyone's position was well respected. Yeah, and everybody felt important in the care of that patient. So that was very different.
Yeah. Does that clinic still exist?
Yeah, the clinic still exists. It still exists. We still have the genetics clinic once a week. in fact, when after we had established a niche here in Lansing, we started servicing the communities. We started running the genetics clinic in Flint, one in Grand Rapids, and one in Kalamazoo. We started doing it. This department started doing it. And so, but now I think we've now reduced our clinics to just three sites, Flint, Kalamazoo, and Lansing. Okay. And we've reduced the frequency of going to Flint and Kalamazoo. But the clinic still exists. And we are still trying to incorporate the spirit and the principles and the philosophies we used to, that we're still trying to incorporate it today. Yeah.
But you can't get the whole faculty involved.
We can't get the whole faculty involved anymore, that's correct. That's correct.
Did you go to faculty meetings in those early days?
Occasionally. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big meeting person, so occasionally I did attend faculty meetings. What is so refreshing about those faculty meetings was the degree of collegiality. Everybody was so upbeat. Anybody who says something is coming up with ideas. I mean, it was actually scary when you think about it now, because those ideas at that time were so outlandish. They looked outlandish, but today, all of those ideas of those days are the things we are seeing today, yeah. And that actually gives me greater appreciation for what I was part of.
Were you recruited into the department, or did you just sort of show up one day?
You know, I think I was recruited by default. It was Jim Higgins who was recruited into the department.
Okay.
And I was part of Jim Higgins' team.
Okay.
And so as we began to produce, you know, it became evident that, or it became obvious that, Jim Higgins was doing it in collaboration with myself.
Yeah.
So that's how I got attracted to or dragged into the department. Yeah. Yes. So it was recruiting Jim Higgins. Mm-hmm. And since I was part of that team, I was also recruited indirectly. Yes.
Okay. And so then eventually you decided to go to medical school.
Yes.
Why?
Well, the reasons are multiple. Perhaps the most important of the reasons was Dean Hunt, the late Dean Hunt.
Okay.
In those days, you could just walk into the dean's office.
Yep.
Or the dean can just see you walking past his office and will scream at you and to come and sit down. I mean, it was such a joy. And when I had finished my PhD and I was in the faculty full time, and at the end of the year, I gave notice that I wanted to leave, to go back to Nigeria. Dean Hunt called me one day and said, "Look, you know, you would be a lot more useful if you combined an MD degree, a clinical medicine, with your current experience as a researcher, and that would be invaluable." You know, that admonition came rather late in the day, you know, because I had packed all my stuff and I was ready to go.
Mm.
So, and then he went on and predicted all the difficulties I was going to have trying to do the things that I'm doing here now. Said there are not very many places where people are this open-minded. In fact, there are some schools here where you and Jim Higgins will not be able to accomplish the things you've accomplished just because you don't have MD degrees. But we don't care here because you are as important as anybody else.
And that was one of Andy's great...
Yes, exactly. So I said, okay, let me think about it. I'm leaving anyway, but let me think about it. When I get back home, and if I find that your advice is the way to go, I'll call you. It did not take me 6 months after I arrived in Nigeria to realize what he was saying. I could not even collect urine from patients.
Yes.
That's how bad it was. I said, I have to be a doctor to collect urine? I mean, it was totally ridiculous. And here I was, I had this grant from the World Health Organization to do a screening for inborn errors of metabolism in Nigeria. And I could not do it. So I said, well, let me begin a crusade. And the crusade is going to be educating these doctors about the value of people like me.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I was beating my head against a hard rock.
Yep.
So 3 years into being in Nigeria, one day I picked up the phone and called Dean Hunt. He said, "Yes, is that you? I wondered how long it would take you to call me. Come back." And that's how I came back.
Okay.
Just like that. To do medicine. Yeah. That's how I came into medicine.
What year was that?
I came back in 1974.
Okay.
Yes, 1974, okay. Which is, 32 years ago, 31 years ago.
Had the school changed much?
Oh, tremendously. The school has changed tremendously.
In what way?
In several ways. The very first way is the fact that we have brought in to prominent positions individuals who did not share the same dream and the same vision. And so even though they claim to appreciate the vision and the dream, they've tried to drag us back into conventional study of medicine.
Who were these?
Well, it would be difficult for me to name names because it's been a very complex array of individuals, you know, different. So if I start naming names, it would be unfair to those I name, and I would be missing individuals who probably played the greatest role. But the fact is that, for instance, we don't used to do any board exams. Board exams.
Yeah.
It was not felt necessary. This is a university. We train you as a doctor. Go and do your boards if you want to. And it was so, all of the pressure of board, and you must pass your board this before you move on to this, all of it disappeared. You see. However, because there were no people here able to articulate the beauty of that kind of pressure-free learning environment, we allowed the AAMC, during side visits, to talk us into doing boards. And so the curriculum now has been modified considerably to prepare the students to pass boards. You see.
That is partly a trade-off because AAMC was also horrified by Track 2.
By Track 2.
Yes. How can you train medical students if they don't have lectures or classes?
Exactly. Which in itself is because we did not have the people to articulate it.
Yep.
You see. Because Track 2 was perhaps one of the boldest steps this institution took. And I'm sorry to see it go completely. Well, it's not completely. We still do the Track 2, but we now do it as problem-based learning, PBL and all of that stuff. But the truth is that if you ask any of the students today, the problem-based learning is their greatest and most beautiful experience in their 2 years.
Yep.
And they learn the most from that experience. See. There are institutions now in this country, I understand, who have stolen this idea of Track 2 and have run away with it. You know, I've developed it, I've refined it, and I'm doing great things with it. But we haven't been able to sustain it as we would have liked to. Yeah.
Partly, it became awfully expensive, they say. I taught Track 2. I loved Track 2. The students were fun. Did you do Track 2 or Track 1?
I did Track 1. Mm-hmm. I did Track 1 because of an accelerated program which was designed for me. Yes. Yes. Oh, Track 2 was beautiful. I loved it. Because when I graduated, I then started teaching Track 2.
Yeah. Yes. see. So then you finished your MD and you went into, did you go directly into a residency?
Yes, directly. Okay. Yes. I finished and went straight into a residency. Yes.
Who was residency director then?
You know, George Baker.
Okay.
George Baker was the residency director at the time I came in, yes. And he was the resident director when I finished.
Yeah. So what was the residency like?
You know, the residency in pediatrics was here was an experience of altruistic care. We had our clinics where the patients were.
Yeah.
And we served the three hospitals. We never discriminated. Mm-hmm. So we had a clinic in St. Lawrence, which is downtown inner city. Yeah. Had a clinic in Ingham Medical Center. The only place we didn't have a clinic was Sparrow, because they didn't want us to have a clinic there. Our residents at that time would finish treating patients and find that the patients don't have a way of getting home. They put them in their car and drive them home.
Mm.
Our residents at that time, we were driving to the homes of patients to make sure that they took the drugs. So we taught residents how to give care where care is most needed. I remember one resident at one point when who had a patient, and he went to the home of this patient. He came back to clinic, was totally speechless, kept asking, what is the problem? Oh, no, I can't say anything. What is the problem? He finally broke down and said, look, I never believed that any human beings live the way these people lived. Mm. You need to go to the home to see.
Yeah.
Now I understand when they come late. Now I understand when they come in with filthy. Now I understand, on and on.
Yeah.
So that single experience alone totally changed his entire outlook and his entire relationship to these patients. Following day, he went to him and brought a bunch of clothes from his children and gave it to them. Take cookie to the house to give to this. So the training was a very, very positive one. It taught us how to appreciate human beings and how to appreciate the fact that it is a privilege for us to give that service. That was what the residency was like.
Okay. Fast forward 20 years when you became residency director. How had the residency changed?
Well, the residency has changed in the sense that now we have so many masters to serve. Our residency particularly was unique in the sense that we are serving not only the ACGME, which is the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, but we're also serving the AOA, which is the American Osteopathic Association. So we have to meet accreditation for both groups. The ACGME has now mandated us to do so many things. Oh, we need to do this curriculum, we need to do that curriculum, we need to do it. By the time you put all of this curriculum you have to do together, for you to be able to do the things we used to do, you've got to stretch residency to 5 years.
Yeah.
Or if it's going to remain 3 years, you don't have time for that kind of what now looks like luxury, but which is one of the things I learned medicine from the most. So we have all of these competing guidelines that we have to adhere to. Consequently, some of the innovations in learning and in training which evolved here, we cannot implement them.
Hmm.
That's the result of these competing forces. Yeah.
So how did you handle that when you became residency director?
Well, you know, every opportunity that I had to introduce a program that reflected my training, you know, I introduced it. For instance, it was when I became resident director that we negotiated Cristo Rey, because we used to keep the patients at MSU.
Yeah.
Nobody shows up. The distance for you to get from downtown to MSU, you have to change buses three, four times. These parents don't have time to do that. So we therefore that gave us an opportunity to move the clinic again back to a community that is in need. Cristo Rey did not quite answer it, but you know, yep, it was an improvement over what we had. So that is the kind of mm-hmm. that kind of measures that we tried to introduce when we had the opportunity. It was at that time that we also began to run this Ingham County Health Clinic, where all of the kids were underprivileged and underserved kids, you know. So we maintained that spirit of altruistic medicine in that fight by doing that. We also developed integrated rotation. What's the name now? IGP. Okay, integrated general pediatrics. Yep. You remember that?
Yes.
That was a special thing for us, because for us to fulfill all of the rotation requirements, we needed to carve out those four rotations,
yeah,
to be able to do ingenious things. I try to encourage students, residents, to do more than one single rotation in rural pediatrics,
mm-hmm,
because that is where the spirit of, yeah, training a pediatrician the way I was trained, that is where we'll get it from. So I use the IGP as a cover to be able to do some of these ingenious things that we learned. Yeah, those are that's the only way I could do it. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any? Probably not. When I came in 1970,
mm-hmm,
we had a clinic at the Ingham County Health Department.
That's right. That's correct.
And we gave that up.
You gave that up. Yes.
And COM took it over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, now that we look back in retrospect, maybe we're not astute enough to know that COM was going to just jump at every opportunity, yeah, you know. We thought that they would also come and try to be as academic as we were, as to be intellectual as we were, as everybody were. But no, their presence here was to give service. So they had all the service contracts. So up till now, COM, all they have done really is service.
Yeah.
Service, clinical work. And although in my books, that is not what I would expect an academic physician to do and to make progress in. They have thrived in it. Perhaps we were short-sighted. Perhaps we should have created another track of physicians, mm-hmm, who want to do just that. There was no way we could serve Ingham County Health Department the way we conceived care to be.
Yeah.
There's no way we could have. You see, we were too slow for them. We were not we're not seeing masses as they would like us to. Because after I see the patient, I like to present it to David Callan, and what my concerns are about social issues. David Callan would like to go see the patients and explore some more, and then come and educate me about my misconceptions or my correct conceptions. And then the social worker, they don't have time for that, you see. But that was what made us such a unique department, because we're able to tap into all of these resources and expertise in the care of the patients, and we gave better care at that time.
How come we haven't been able to translate that into the realities of today's healthcare system? Is it not possible to do it? Or will we, you know, were we too insistent on doing it our way?
Well, you know, that is a good question. There is enough blame to go around everybody. But then there are areas of this that are beyond our control. We don't make healthcare policies. Okay, we don't make healthcare policies. When healthcare policies are made that are obnoxious to your concept of medicine, you have nothing to do. There's nothing you can do about it. You either conform or refuse to conform. For a long time, we resisted conforming and thought that we could educate the policymakers about how to make policies. But we didn't have the political clout. We didn't have the wherewithal to be able to change those policies. And so now we are struggling. We are struggling to conform. And every time you conform, they add more regulatory things. You conform, they add more. So it's been so difficult. You cannot practice medicine the way we were taught and the way we conceived of medicine being practiced under the present atmosphere. You just can't do that.
Is there a different way we should be teaching our people to practice medicine?
Boy, that would be sad if we'd really change the way we teach students to practice medicine. I think we should continue to teach students the way to practice medicine, but we should also continue to teach them about healthcare policies, how they came about, what they have done to, you know, what they have done to medical for to healthcare delivery and the practice of medicine. They need to know that too. Yes.
I mean, you know, I used to make teaching rounds in the hospital. And then things changed, and the patients weren't there long enough to be a problem to the residents. Well, teaching rounds in the hospital were great when I could do them, but I couldn't teach those things in the hospital anymore. I moved to the clinics for a while.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and then the clinics got busy because you got to push patients through.
That's right. Exactly what I was explaining to you. You see, again, what is going on now was predicted years ago. Yeah. People like Bill Weil, they told us long ago, the learning of pediatrics is not in hospital. She said it.
Yeah.
Pediatrics does not belong in hospital. It belongs out there, you see, because you are seeing children in disease and in health, okay? And children's diseases don't necessarily have to end up in the hospitals. So all of those predictions are realities today. And that's part of the things I told you that when I think about them, I get really amazed at how 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, almost 40 years ago, people who are still here could predict what is going on today. Yes.
Okay, let's go back now. You went to medical school here, you finished your residency, and then did you go back to Nigeria?
Yes, I did. After working for about a few years here as in the with Higgins again, Jim Higgins again, and also doing a hematology oncology fellowship. And I went back to Nigeria, right? Yes. And I stayed there for 7 years before I came back this time.
Did your training here prepare you for what you found there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I would never have been able to accomplish the things I did in Nigeria if I had been trained elsewhere. Never.
What did you do in Nigeria for those 7 years?
Well, the 7 years that I was there, I went back there as the director of the Institute of Child Health. And as director of the Institute of Child Health, one of the things that I was advocating was preventive pediatrics, immunizations, prevention of diarrhea diseases, prevention of infectious diseases. See, back in Nigeria, in an underdeveloped world, the things that kill children are political diseases. They are totally preventable. You see, if you provide food, adequate food for the children, they will not be so malnourished.
Yeah.
See, if you provide enough immunizations to immunize all the children, there will be no measles, no mumps, no... You can control politically a lot of the things that kill children. So that was where my emphasis was, trying to highlight, you know, and to do epidemiology work to find out the distribution of all of these various entities that kill children in Nigeria. That was my job, role as a director. And when I finished my stint as a director, of course, they quickly moved me because of the successes that I achieved in trying to organize child health care in a preventive manner. I was moved to become the chief medical director of the teaching hospital. And as chief medical director, what I did was to establish what I called community outreach programs, you see. There's no way I would have been able to do that if I was not trained here. I would never have known the concept of community medicine. I would never. So I established all of these community-based centers where I sent residents to go around the place and take care of people. It was a great thing, you know. And, you know, so that was what my training prepared me for.
Did your training help you in dealing with the politics of the situation?
Well, no, it did not. I'll tell you, because I was very politically immature and naive. I got myself into trouble by making statements which probably I should never have made. But my training here prepared me to say, my training says it the way it is, you know. For instance, I recruited a young man from Germany who was a gastroenterologist, pediatrician, and he decided, one of his first things was to organize a workshop for diarrheal disease in children, the prevention of diarrheal disease in children. And as director of the Institute of Child Health, I was to open this big workshop. Here was the Minister of Health and some other government officials, and I got up without thinking. I did not write it down. I mean, I just got up. I said, well, you know, I said, never in the history of this country have I seen so many children abandoned. I said, mothers would come, put their children in the corridor of the Institute of Child Health and walk away and never see them again because they can't feed them. You look at the children, they are malnourished. I said, any country that can allow its greatest assets, children, to starve this way is an irresponsible country. I mean, I just went on. I said, what are we trying to do, create a generation of imbeciles? You know, on and on. And before I got to my office, I was arrested. That I was trying to incite students to riot against the government. And I said, no, they wanted the copy of the speech. I said, I never wrote it down. And they never believed me. And all throughout for the next 2 days, excerpts of that speech was on television every day. And I kept praying, please stop this thing. You know, so for 2-3 days, I was under arrest. You know, before they released me. So these are, that's the kind of thing I said. My training here got me into trouble in some ways.
Well, remember, Bill got in trouble with the local medical society.
Exactly.
For testifying in front of, I guess it was Kennedy's committee, that there were children in Lansing who didn't get adequate health care.
That is correct. I remember that.
So you had a good role model.
A good role model, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So then you came back here, as I remember, there was some urgency to get you here.
Yes, well, you know, really, the reason I came back was one day in my, I was being frustrated already, so I was thinking. And I got a letter from Mike Nesloff that if I would like to come back, because Renuka was going to go on maternity leave, they needed somebody to help Roshni if I could come back. You know, I didn't think twice about that. Mm-hmm. I was ready to come back, you see. Now, to get me here, I have to go through all kinds of bottlenecks and things like that. But that was the only one of the reasons why I was motivated to come back at the time I did. But I was already contemplating it anyway. So that was just, you know, fortuitous event.
What was the department like that you came back to?
Boy, by the time I got back here, the department had metamorphosed so much that all of the great things I looked forward to, the collegiality, the spirit, you know, and the ideas, I mean, we're not there anymore. It's as if everybody's so preoccupied with survival, with personal survival, that all of those great things, we're not there anymore. The ability to mobilize talents and knowledge and people's skills was not there anymore. That was the very first thing that I noticed. And then secondly, people began to express doubts. And that tells me that the morale is very low. Yeah, so those were the things that quite noticeable.
Okay. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I guess the only thing I can actually say, think of, is that what happened to us was probably because of the stresses that the healthcare system was experiencing. And those stresses are more likely to affect us because we were really not orthodox. We were very unorthodox. And if it could affect the orthodox department, you can imagine how it will affect us. So we were not prepared, we are not able to deal with those stressors. Those stressors were enormous. Those stressors from Medicaid cuts, stressors from budgetary cuts, stressors from the university thinking that the medical school is too expensive to run. Why can't you run it as cheaply as the other medical school? You know, all of those stressors, you know, came to bear very heavily on our department, you know, because ideas cost money to implement.
Yeah.
And you can have all the grand ideas you want in this world. If you don't have the means, you can't implement them. Right. And that's what they demand. That was our problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You came back and you did a combination of genetics and hematology.
That is correct, okay. Yeah.
What was Higgins' lab like at that point? Did it become a joint lab with you, or was it always Higgins' lab?
No, it was always, we always called it Higgins' lab because it was mostly his creation. I was just his assistant at that time, and we created that lab. Higgins's lab at that time had lost a lot of vigor and vitality. And the vigor and vitality in the lab was provided by the graduate students. Now we didn't have any.
Yeah.
There's no money. Yeah. No money to recruit graduate students. No money to keep them there. We didn't have graduate students. So although we continued with our Grand Rapids Clinic, our Kalamazoo Clinic, our Flint Clinic, and our clinics here, you could see that something was not you know, right. And so all of these graduate students we used to drag with us and take to clinics and show patients, yeah. We're not there anymore. Higgins' lab produced some of the brightest clinical geneticists, all of our medical geneticists in this country. And they are all heading different genetics programs elsewhere. So we didn't have exactly the same vitality that we had before, you know.
Yeah. Okay. And you split your time between genetics and hematology?
That is correct.
And you almost, as I recall, you sort of gave up doing research.
Well, yes, I'll tell you. Well, I did not give up doing research, you know. I had to make a choice. And the choice that I had to make was my growing children and my research work. The clinical part I cannot do anything about because those are assigned by the chair. You have to do this, so I have to do them. For me to do research, it means I have to take away time from my growing children.
Mm.
My children were growing. I was a single parent when I came back.
Really?
Yes, I was a single parent.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. When I came back, I was a single parent. And I had these teenage kids. And so I therefore decided that, no, research can wait. I'm going to spend this time with these kids so that I can get them to a certain level. And research will always be there. And I can always turn back and go and do research. But Higgins and I continue to flirt with all kinds of research ideas, you know. We wrote a few grants which did not click, but we were still thinking. And so that's how my research, you know, went to the back burner.
How did your work intersect with that of Rachel's?
You know, Rachel, by the time I came back, Rachel had occupied a niche in genetics. And that niche was amniocentesis and alpha fetal protein and all of those things. She was guarding that niche very jealously. And of course, when I came back, I'm Jim Higgins's person. And so Jim Higgins was tabooed from invading that territory, which astonished me. That was the department that I came to meet now.
Yeah.
Not the old department in which there was so much cross-fertilization. It was such that we had to say, okay, let her take over that niche. We'll take over the one that doesn't involve her. So that's how we were separated.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So how come you stayed?
Well, there was a time I thought I would not stay. I actually interviewed for positions in different places. I interviewed for chair of pediatrics at Chattanooga. I interviewed for a few places. And I got appointed. I interviewed for chief of ambulatory pediatrics in New York at Woodhull Hospital. I got that job. I mean, I got several jobs. But, you know, When I look at my life and I see that here I was, a young African boy brought all the way from Africa, brought to this institution, and see what I turned out to be, I cannot but owe enormous allegiance to this institution. First and foremost, and to the Department of Pediatric and Human Development secondarily. So that statement tells it all.
Yeah.
Okay. And I wasn't about to abandon the ship just because I thought it was sinking. I wasn't about to do that. And so my enormous sense of gratitude for what I got out of this place is what kept me here. Yes.
Okay. Tell me about the chairman you knew. You knew Bill. You worked with Bill.
Yeah.
Bill Weil.
Yeah. Bill Weil is in a class of his own. I mean, I have said it over and over again every opportunity that I've had. He is in a class of his own. When he was retiring, I wrote a poem titled "The Man." All of my thoughts about him are in those verses. He has a knack about him of seeing talents. I mean, before anybody knows, he's seen talents, and he has a knack about bringing people together, relationships. He's just special. After Bill, then Ray Helfer took over temporarily, you know, apart from the fact that every one of you also acted as chair at some point, associate chair. And Ray Helfer, because Ray Helfer's style was quite similar to Bill's style, but he was a little bit more politically astute than Bill is. Bill says it the way he sees it. Ray Helfer will be a little bit more diplomatic. He was more diplomatic in the way he presents. Otherwise, they have the same vision, the same style. After that, then we had Marshall Klaus. Is it Marshall Klaus?
Yeah.
All right. We had Marshall Klaus, whom I never had much relationship with. He was just coming in when I left.
Okay.
And by the time I came back, he had gone.
Right.
So I didn't know very much about him. But then I know Mike Nesloff, who took over from Marshall Klaus. Mike had a military style to him, which astonished me. It's either his way or no way. My belief, and in all my encounters with Mike, and we never got along as a result of that, there is always another way. For every thesis, there is an antithesis. You cannot just say that your way is the way or not. That doesn't happen. And I'm not used to that type of autocracy, at least not here. So that style alienated a lot of people. That style polarized the department tremendously, you know. And that polarized department has really not been able to recover from that. Then Al Sparrow took over from, essentially, Al Sparrow took over from Mike Nesloff. Our style is status quo. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So, because of that...
And I think if it broke, leave it broke.
If it broke, leave it broke, exactly. But, you know, in spite of that, Al was very, very amenable to suggestions. He would listen. The only thing is that if you make suggestions to Al, he makes you in charge of implementing the suggestions. So, because of that, some of us... We are very limited in what we asked Al to, what we suggested to him.
Yeah.
But we'll put you in charge of it. You know, otherwise, Al developed the primary care, primary pediatric section completely.
Mm-hmm.
It was not in existence, really tried not in existence. He came in and developed it. And that is because he listened to advice, where the emphasis is now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that general pediatrics, our general pediatric division, is actually a creation of Al, and that's a very, very positive thing for him. And now Dr. Davis has taken over from Al. Dr. Davis, of course, is full of ideas, a young man, bright, wants to move mountains, wants to change the name of the department, all of these things, you know. They are great things. I don't agree with them, but they are great. At least the fact that he comes and thinks about
mm-hmm.
them is great for the department. Yep. And the only thing is for us all to be able to rally around and try to be realistic in the things we know we can accomplish with the resources that we have. Yeah, those are all the chairmen so far, I think. Yes.
Do you think you can pull it off? Or do they have to wait for more people to retire?
No. No. The more people retire, the more depleted the department is. It will be difficult to replace the people who are retiring. You can replace them in terms of human bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot replace them in terms of ideas and the talent they bring to bear. No, you don't have to wait for them to retire. I would like for him to accomplish some of the things he wants to accomplish. Whether he will remains to be seen.
Yeah.
I don't see that there's a lot of resources out there for him to be able to do it. The people in Grand Rapids are very aggressive and very viciously aggressive in trying to make that place the center.
Yeah.
And so that is going to undermine a lot of things that he wants mm-hmm. to do. But we hope that he's able to accomplish it.
How about deans you've had contact with?
You know, I have had contact with all of the deans.
Okay.
Dean Hunt, again, you know,
yeah.
of course I don't need to talk about Dean Hunt. He's legendary. In fact, in the letter that I wrote when he passed away to the board, I asked that they should name Service Road after Dean Hunt.
Mm.
Because he really, if we cannot honor him, I don't know who else will.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that the entire academic medicine should honor him because he brought all the changes that we see today, all the positive things we see today in learning, all Dean Hunt's ideas. He was succeeded by Don Westin. Don Westin is still very much around. And Don Westin actually followed the path of Dean Hunt to the letter, followed the path to the letter, followed the concept to the letter. Again, this is a tribute to Dean Hunt, bringing people of like mind and like ideas together to form this medical school. So Dean Westin did his part and did it very well. Then Dean Westin was unfortunately succeeded by Bill Abbott. And Bill Abbott is, as well-meaning as he is a man who is prepared to compromise a lot. You know, so he compromised a lot to administration.
Mm-hmm.
He bowed to administration's pressures. He believed administration when they said that we are too expensive to run. He believed administration. He was a typical administration person who really has no loyalty. He did not have the kind of loyalty to the college that I would have expected him to have. And then, of course, after Bill Abbott, they brought Glenn Davis, who really never functioned.
Okay.
Glenn Davis came into a situation which he never thought he would come into. He came to be dean and suddenly he has to move the medical school away to another community. Then, of course, he started developing resistance. And as he developed resistance, of course, he was getting into the skin of the administrators. So I'm not surprised that he did not last but 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I did not get to know Glenn Davis very well.
I never even met him.
Yeah, I see. I never got to know him very well. I interviewed him when he came, and I found him quite interesting. And I voted for him. I was a little concerned about his appointments when he came. And I don't know what informed him to make the appointments he made. Let me leave it at that. And there is a law in business. I think it's Peter's law. When you promote a person beyond their level of competence,
right,
you are creating disaster.
Yeah.
You see, and I hope he hasn't created too many disasters. And, so that's those are deeds.
If somebody said, "You're joking, what is it that's being unique about the department that we might be able to recapture?" What would you tell them?
Well, the things that I would really like to talk about are things which require a lot of resources to do. But at least we can capture our collegiality. Mm-hmm. You know, there was once upon a time when we were our brother's keepers.
Yeah.
You know, it's fantastic. Bill is in the hospital with his wife. His wife ran into trouble, picks up the phone and calls Roshni Kulkarni.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Roshni was so honored. Roshni then picks up the phone, calls me. "Jovi, I just got a call from Bill." I mean, Roshni was so honored. I don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
I don't see it anymore. Bill can pick up the phone and call you any time of the day, and you'll be honored to hear him.
Yeah.
I don't see it anymore. This does not require money.
That's right.
So I think that if we can recapture that, we make any progress. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were thinking the other day about subspecialty rounds. Every time I see Saroge, she says, "David, you should come to subspecialty round with me." I said, "Why?" I remember when almost the entire faculty went to subspecialty grants.
Yes. Oh, yes. Now you see one or two, yeah, you are lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see one or two, you are lucky. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you think that's something that a chairman could change? Or are people, you know, too busy trying to run clinics and see patients?
People are too busy.
Mm-hmm.
People are too busy trying to run clinics. Oh, yes. The bottom line is making money. Oh, yeah. Chairman comes, the chairman tells us now we have to do hematology-oncology clinic every day of the week. You know, where are the patients?
Yeah.
Is that good service?
They're in Grand Rapids.
You know. Yes, so so there'll be no time for that. No, people, he can't enforce it. He tells me every time, "Oh, I'd like you to be coming to ground rounds at 8 o'clock in the morning." I say, "No, I'm not coming to ground rounds at 8 o'clock in the morning." I say, "How many people are there in the ground rounds? You look at it." Yeah. Anyway, so it's tough. It's a tough thing. Very tough.
What about our relationships with the community physicians?
Oh, that is all dead. There's none.
Mm-hmm.
There is none. No relationship with the community physicians. Yeah. None. Every year we used to have a common party.
Mm-hmm.
All of them would be there. You know, we used to hold residency meetings in the houses of these community physicians. Yeah. They are not even involved anymore. They are not. They are just gone. Gone. None. None. You know. not there. There's no way that Dele can rekindle that and make them more a part of our system. It's up to him.
Mm-hmm.
I've made those suggestions to him before. Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed the department party, there were only one or two. And by the time I got there, half our faculty weren't there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Any final words?
My only final word really is not often do people have the opportunity to express gratitude. And I really want to thank all of you guys who were the leaders of our department for what you did for countless generations of people like me. And the ideas that all of you brought into the Department of Pediatrics, a big band of human development, the idea that you guys brought into that department have been some of the things that have guided my own practice and my own philosophy over the years. And in turn, I have imparted that to generations of students. So this is my opportunity to pay tribute to all of you. For your selflessness, for your willingness to share your ideas and your brilliance and your talents. And I'm a beneficiary of that.
But, you know, it's a two-way street.
That's true.
Because we gained also.
That's true.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.